Today's Teisho will be on case 28 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection, or the Blue Cliff Record. Case 28 is entitled, What the Holy Ones Have Not Preached. Main subject, Nansen came to see Yakujo Nehan Osho. Joe said, is there any Dharma that the Holy Ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it is not mind. It is not Buddha. It is not things. Joe said, you've just preached. Nansen said, I am like this. How about you? Joe said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell you if there is preaching or no preaching? Nansen said, I don't follow you. Joe said, I have talked quite enough for you. Secho's verse, ancestors and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging, looking southward, see the great bear. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. We had some really deep sitting this morning in our virtual sangha, our virtual zendo. People actually sit very, very well this way. You know, it's possible to be attached to a physical space. When I was in Seattle, we had a place where we practiced for many years, and I loved that space. It's possible to be attached to that, but you know, that having a space, a place, a building, a temple, none of those things are really necessary. And in fact, they can be obstructions. You know, we're not physically located in any particular place right now. But this morning there was amazingly deep practice. People were sitting absolutely still. You know, and in some ways, this way of doing things is more demanding than sitting in a zendo. You know, in a zendo, we're organized into rows and the lights are low. If you have to scratch your head, if you're in the back, nobody's going to see you scratch your head. But here, everybody has, you know, all the tiles are on the screen. Anybody moving, I can just look and see them moving, and nobody's moving. So it's really wonderful to see that kind of deep practice. Really, really wonderful. Thank you so much. It's thrilling, actually, to sit together with people who practice so wholeheartedly. It's thrilling. So this koan is a wonderful koan, especially for now. Nansen came to see Yakujo, and Joe said, Yakujo meaning Joe, Joe said, is there any Dharma that the Holy Ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. So let me back up a little bit from the koan. You know, I was driving here this morning. Some of you know that I do come to our zendo to run the sit, because the Wi-Fi in Lucy Stone Hall is so much more reliable and steady and strong, or actually the internet system is, because I have a Ethernet cable on the computers, is so much better than at my house. You know, we generally have been able to have our sutra study group from there, and the Dokusan seems to work, but every once in a while people begin to slow down, and that would be worrisome in this setting. So I come here And I drive from my house in Plainfield over here. And I was listening to the radio on the way over. And there was a professor, she's a historian, and she has written a new book on how technology changes human life. And it was fascinating, you know. She said that basically we don't think about the ways technology changes our lives. We think of technology as this tool that we use or we don't use. And she said, but, you know, actually, we make the tools, but then the tools make us. And she said, actually, our tools have totally transformed our lives. And she started talking about the fact that what we call the family, she said, didn't even exist more than a couple hundred years ago. And she said, you know, we think of the family, we think of the family as the sort of core institution of human life. You know, if most people think, okay, there's the United States, there's New Jersey, but when you come right down to it, there's the family. That's always been true throughout human history. And she said, that's actually not so. She said, you know, the family really begins, as we know it, with an invention, she said, that completely transformed human life. And she said it was the plow. And she said the plow, agriculture, transformed human society. She said before then, she said, there really weren't families as we know them. There were human groups. And she said human groups usually were about 20, 25 people, about the number of people who are here this morning, as a matter of fact. So like us, our song is about the size of the typical human group 5,000 years ago. And people were basically hunters and gatherers, and they had small communities. And she said, everybody owned everything in common. So, you know, basically, if you were a hunter and you went out and you bagged a buffalo, let's say, and you brought it home, you didn't eat it yourself, you shared it with everybody. And she said, basically, all the kids were raised by everybody in the tribe, in the group. And she said, it's true that people, there were marriages, people did get married, but she said they, you know, her studies said, marriages didn't necessarily last a lifetime. You lived with a certain person for a certain time and you had some children with her or with him. And then later you might live with somebody else and have some children with her and him. And the thing is that the children were like the raised by everybody in the tribe, she said. And then she said, I used to be an anthropology major, so I found this stuff fascinating. And she said, you know, when they invented agriculture, that's when you get one man and one woman. And she said, because now property is everything. Things aren't shared. And everything is work. Everything's hard work. You know, when you're a hunter-gatherer, you just go and look for the buffalo, right? You look for, if you're hunting deer, you could just go by my yard. And there's 50 deer out in my yard this morning, probably. That you wander into things. And with agriculture, you know, everything is hard. You have to plow the soil. You have to plant the whatever. You know, in China, you know, if you know about rice cultivation in China and Japan, unbelievably demanding. So, you know, with rice, you might not know this, but you plant the rice plant twice, you know. You plant the rice plant once until it's rice shoots. And then you dig it up and people put those in a basket. And then you take them out into a flooded field, right? And you replant those shoots into the wet soil. And this like multiplies the food five times, right? You get all this rice by doing this. But this is incredibly labor intensive. And this woman said, she didn't get into rice, but she said, you know, agriculture requires a lot of labor. Where do you get your labor? When people were hunters and gatherers, that wasn't a problem. But when you move into agricultural society, suddenly you need workers. And she said there were two ways to get them. One was slavery, right, which actually became very common. And the other was having lots of kids. And she said, so suddenly you produce your labor force, you know, you breed your labor force. And she said, suddenly the marriage between a man and a woman was very, very, very important in a way, and had to be permanent. And she said, you know, if you even look at marriage ceremonies now, she said they go back to early agriculture because the father gives away the daughter to the husband. You know, this is hopefully disappearing from our world, but it's still a remnant of that earlier time, she said. And she said, you know, the woman is kind of a property of the husband in this arrangement. And this was totally different, you know, in the earlier days, women and men were very equal. So, you know, she said, she talked about all this, and I'm thinking, you know, this is really, I mean, I guess I learned some of this in school, but, you know, it's really interesting that to realize that the thing we think of as the most permanent sort of like bedrock human relationship, the family, isn't permanent or bedrock at all. And she went on and she said, you know, when we began to have industrialization, the first people to leave the home and go work in factories weren't men, they were women. Men had to stay and plant the rice, or men had to stay and sow the wheat or feed the cows. But women and children, young children, you know, would go and work in the factories to make cash money. And she said this was ultimately very liberating for women again. And you get this family situation closer to what we have now, where people are very mobile. And she said, you know, basically, she said families until about 200 years ago were a business deal. You know, love didn't enter into the picture. It was really about money. You know, it was a business deal. Your family would make an alliance with this family, and that was you were expected to go along with that. So, you know, if you look at the family, you know, as she describes it, nothing has stayed the same. Nothing. You know, we've gone from hunters and gatherers, where men and women have a lot of personal freedom, but they're all tied to each other and responsible for each other in a small social group like our Sangha. And then you go to an agricultural society where everybody has his own little farm, and farmers are all competing with each other for scarce resources and for labor power. And now women become like property. And it's very important for them to have lots of children. She said, actually, if in early times, if you didn't have children, you could be divorced, you know, because your job was to make a lot of workers. And then she said, in the modern world, we have a totally different system again. And she said that was made possible by like steam engines and machinery. And, you know, listening to her, it's like the thing we think of as the most stable, the distinctive human feature, the family, isn't a distinctive human feature at all. It's constantly changing, and it's changing right now. And one of the reasons we have so much conflict in our society is that people are trying to change it in ways that other people find objectionable. So, you know, the idea of two men or two women having a family, that bothers a lot of people. They think that the nuclear family, the mother and father and children, that's an eternal arrangement, you know, but it's not. And the fact is that I have a good friend of mine, she's a historian, and she had a child by herself. I mean, she had a child with somebody, but she's not married, she's raising her son by herself. And that takes a lot of courage, but that's a decision she made. And she's doing well. She's doing that takes a lot, but you know, that's a possibility too. So, you know, there are all these ways to arrange our lives together, our romantic lives together, and our reproductive lives together. And it doesn't have to look like it did in the 1950s. And, you know, lots of people are nostalgic for that, but you know, listening to her, I realize, you know, things are constantly changing. Things are constantly changing. You know, this shouldn't be, Well, I this shouldn't be a big surprise to us as Buddhists, right? Because, you know, one of the first thing the Buddha said was, you know, there's suffering, right? The fact of suffering. And he traced suffering back to impermanence. You know, we suffer because things are always changing and we want them to stay the same. And, you know, the impermanence was something the Buddha taught. It was like his first teaching was the reality of suffering, which in itself is kind of an interesting thing to talk about, right? Most people, you know, many religious prophets have talked about heaven or about, miracles. And Buddha didn't. He said, you know, to be a human being is to suffer at certain points in your life. And suffering is like this bottom line for human beings. And then he said, and it's a bottom line for human beings because we're because of the way we live our lives. You know, we want things to be the same, but they're changing all the time. And that causes us a lot of, you know, clinging to what is when things are changing all the time causes us a lot of anguish. And I think this is really, I think it's another way in which Buddhism is kind of unusual. You know, I think many religions, I don't want to say most religions, but many religions take the opposite approach, right? They say, look, there are some things that don't change. There's like the rock of ages idea, right? There's some things that don't change. You know, there are some things that are above time or outside of time. They're timeless truths, and here they are. And this creates a lot of problems for religion because you have a revelation, and then two people disagree about the revelation, and then you have a conflict. You know, but the Buddha said, actually, you know, everything changes all the time. And, you know, this is very difficult for us as human beings because we're symbolic creatures, right? We deal with change by sort of like creating these structures in our mind that are supposed to be enduring, right? So, you know, repetition leads us to pursue, to form an image of how things should be, and that stability is helpful for us, right? So it does help to say, okay, you know, I have obligations to my family. You know, I have obligations to my family. The family is important, right? So you know, having some way of organizing human relations is really important, right? We can't do without it. We need some men and women are going to have children somehow, right? But how are they going to do it? They could do it in ways that are terrible and destructive for everybody involved, or they could do it in ways that are helpful and beneficial to everybody involved. You know, so we're, you know, we develop something like the institution of marriage as a way of hopefully not being too destructive and being helpful and enabling. And in our time, you know, people 200 years ago said, well, why don't we make marriage about love, which nobody had ever thought of before? And I think that's a wonderful idea myself. Let's make marriage about love. You know, instead of making it about business, a business deal, let's make it about people who love each other. So, you know, we need some kind of permanence, but all forms of permanence are imaginary. They're imaginary, you know, and this is like a tension for us, right? Because, you know, I have to say, I have missed going to my office. You know, I actually love getting up in the morning and sitting. And then if I have to teach, I go into my office and I get ready for my classes. And then after my classes, I sit in my office and students come into my office. And I have one of the best offices at Rutgers. Don't tell anybody, but it's a great office. I have this giant window. You know, I have friends, colleagues who have no windows in their office. I have like this giant window looking out on the, you know, the quad on College Avenue. It's just so beautiful. So I love to sit there and after I teach, I can have a cup of coffee, and students come in, and we chat, and the light comes through the room, and I have some plants. And I love that. I love getting up in the morning and driving to work and teaching my classes and then meeting my students. And then, you know, there's committee meetings and stuff like that. And then I'm like, you know, go to lunch, and then I grade papers in the afternoon and I go home. Now that's all gone, right? And, you know, we don't have to do our work in an office. But, you know, the office was in some ways a really good idea. It was a great idea. I liked it. I even go there sometimes. It's deserted, but just to get the feel again, you know, because doing every day I'm sitting in the same room at the same, you know, computer, it's just not the same experience. So there's something creative and interesting about the office, but it's disappearing, and, you know, it may never come back. So you know, if we get too nostalgic for the office, you know, we forget that things are changing all the time, and it causes me anguish. You know, I'd love to go back to my office. Yesterday I taught, on Thursday I taught two of my classes, and, you know, I have my, I use Zoom just like this, and you can do lots of things on Zoom. You can break people into little groups and send them away, and you can break them into groups of four or groups of five, and they'll work on their own, and then you can reconvene and discuss, just like making little groups in a classroom. But it's not the same. And I miss what used to be, you know. And that causes me some, I don't think I'd call it suffering, but it tugs at my heartstrings a little bit. You know, so that's a human fact. And there's always this tension, because we do need some kind of arrangements. But on the other hand, everything is always changing. So, you know, this is a source of real tension for human beings. And I think right now we're really in a difficult situation, because as a society, we're so ill-equipped for this kind of change. You know, I was reading this article, and they were talking about the rise of conspiracy theories. And I don't know if you have spent much time studying conspiracy theories, but actually conspiracy theories are swirling all around us all the time. And you may have heard of this thing called, I think it's pronounced QAnon, but it's like a network of conspiracy theorists who basically flood the internet with false stories. And you know, the stories can be pretty sordid. I don't know that I want to go into all the details here. And they're absolutely, some of them are absolutely crazy, right? Like, you know, apparently one of the allegations is that the Democrats and the deep state, something called the deep state, are running a child sexual slavery ring. And that Trump is fighting against this, you know, and he's really the hero, right? You know, and the article I read was written by two sociologists, and they were saying, you know, this is a response to like major social change happening very, very fast. And they said that many people in our society are undergoing like three crises at the same time. They said one is like an existential crisis, you know, like, who am I? Where am I? And this is really important, especially for men, right? Because, it was definitely the case that a generation or two ago, a person without a lot of formal education could make a really good living. You know, lots of, my uncle, Jonathan, here in New Jersey, never went to college during the Great Depression. He didn't go to college. He worked in a gas station, and he bought a gas station, and he bought another gas station. And, you know, he had a lot of gas stations, and he actually had a wonderful living. You know, and today, I don't think John would be where he was, right? I think, you know, the idea that a person without much education could work his way into a good life is sort of in the past. So a lot of men are saying, who am I? What am I? You know, I, I can't, there's no fact, you know, there used to be in here in New Jersey, right in Edison, one of the biggest Ford factories in the United States. And it was already empty when I got here 30 years ago, and they closed it down and tore it down. But there used to be, when you drove into, if you drove into Camden, you were driving over from Pennsylvania into Camden, there used to be a big sign that says, New Jersey makes and the world takes, right? So New Jersey was full of factories, and men could get up and go to work. They didn't go to an office, they went to a shop, and they worked all day, and they came home, and they got a nice check, and so on. And all these people are now unable to do this. And, you know, they have jobs that don't pay well, and that affects their self-esteem. So it's like an existential crisis. And then, you know, this, they said there's something called a, they said, this is a, they said it's a, they said it's called an epistemological crisis. In other words, I no longer know what reality is anymore. I no longer know what reality is, right? And that's number two. So, you know, actually, when I was growing up, when you turned on TV, there were three broadcasts. There was NBC, ABC, and CBS. And at 6 o'clock, you could turn to NBC, and there was a newsman, and he would give you the news. And then you turn to CBS, and there was a newsman, and he'd give you the news. And you turn to ABC, and there's a newsman, and he'd give you the news. And the news was the same. You know, it's just different deliverers, right? So, you know, basically, what this meant was that we were all living in the same world. We all got the same information, and we all believed it, right? I remember, this is something younger people here won't remember, but at one time we almost went to war with the Soviet Union. And my parents would watch the evening news. And they got together with all the people in my neighborhood that they were their friends, and they all planned to drive to upstate New York in case there was a nuclear war. I don't know how that would help, but you know, we were all sort of on the same page, right? And now that's not the case. You know, there's all these sources of information, and people don't know what to believe anymore. And then they said, there's also like a third crisis, which is like an institutional crisis. People don't feel like government or businesses are working for them. And I think all of this is true. You know, so we're in a really tough spot right now as a society, because everything that is solid has melted into air, right? And everything that's solid melts into air. And it's happening faster and faster. And, you know, I think the lessons we learn in Buddhism are very helpful for dealing with this, you know, and our training is really very helpful. You know, it's one thing to say everything changes and reflect on that in the comfort of your own home, right? But, you know, when we begin to experience the world that we know and love slipping away and morphing, you know, it gets to be, it's difficult to deal with. And I think a lot of Zen training is about how to deal with that. You know, so you know, in Zen, we do something called koan practice. And I think koan practice actually puts you into an existential crisis, an epistemic crisis, and an institutional crisis. I really do. I think it's like training for when things fall apart. It's training for when things fall apart. You know, so, you know, when we do our Zen practice, we sit down, you know, the way we practice is we sit down on the cushion, and at first you want to be able to enter samadhi. So you watch your breath, and you watch your breath, and you notice that your mind becomes more and more stable, more and more grounded in the moment. You know, so it's like, you know, normally thoughts are pulling us in this direction and that direction, the monkey mind. But you keep coming back to your breath and you begin to notice that your mind has a kind of stability, right? Stability. And, you know, thoughts come and thoughts go. And once you are able to find that stability, which is called, you could call samadhi, you know, you're less caught in your thoughts. You know, so it's a real moment of liberation when people can sit down on the cushion. And, you know, what happens to a lot of people is that their thoughts take over their minds and then they obsess. They go through these circles, right? I'm sure this has happened to you. But, you know, a friend of mine had an experience that is like a nightmare. He was a scientist here at Rutgers. And he received grant money and put it into an account. And he was paying all the people in his lab out of that account. And he went to the bank and they said, oh, that account is empty. And it was like, that can't be true. It can't be empty. And he spent days trying to straighten this out. And the bank had made a mistake. And, you know, what did they do? They corrected the mistake and they gave him a calendar or something like that. They didn't apologize in any other way, I think. So, but the thing is, during that whole period, he was like, he was unable to sleep, right? And he understandably, right? These people were counting on him. He knew this money was there. But, you know, we all do that, right? He couldn't sleep. He just kept lying there and thinking, where's the money? What happened, right? And it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if when things like that happen, we could just turn it off and say, okay, I've contacted the bank. I'll worry about that tomorrow. I'm just going to be in the moment. Right? Wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, instead, we lie in bed and it goes around and around in our heads, and we try to think it through in this way and this way. And what'll I do? And all of that's fantasy, right? It's all kind of self-protection when we feel powerless. We try to think our way out of it, but it would be so nice just to say, I called the bank, they're going to straighten it out, I'm just going to relax. Well, you know, that's actually what we train ourselves to do. You know, instead of getting caught in those cognitive loops, you know, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and after a while, you distance, you create a space between yourself and your mental life, your thoughts. And, you know, when that space becomes wide enough and enduring enough, you begin to see the thoughts arising and going away, and you can also see them. You can see the emotions that sort of trail along those thoughts. You know, what happens is we have a thought and it triggers an emotion. It's like a conditioned response. But if you're able to get into deep samadhi and sustain that state, after a while, you know, you see the thought and you see the emotion, but you don't own it, right? You don't own it. You just say, I'm going to deal with that later. That's just a thought. That's just an emotion. And this is hugely liberating, right? Because actually, we don't even control our own thoughts. You know, if you think about it, we say our thoughts, I'm thinking. But if you look at your mental life, thoughts come into your head and go out of your head in ways you can't control. So you know, basically, we call them my thoughts. You call them your thoughts. But if you look at your mind, the thoughts are coming up on their own. They have their own law. In fact, they're laws of karma, Buddhism would say. The cause and effect is pushing your thoughts along, right? So, you know, we can't control even our thoughts. If I were to ask you, what thought are you going to think next? It's very unlikely you would get it right. You know, thoughts just come into your head unbidden, and they create all of this emotional baggage, right? So, you know, we learn, one of the first things we learn is don't go along for the ride. You know, you get into deep samadhi You get into this place that's very centered and grounded, and you create a space between yourself and your thoughts. The thoughts come and the thoughts go. And you realize, I don't have to be attached to my thoughts. You know, I can sit in this place that is immovable, imperturbable. And when I stay there, I can watch things going without feeling disoriented. Now, you know, the first time this happens to you on the cushion, it might be you might not think much of it, or it might be quite exciting. You know, you can be in a lot of emotional distress, or you can be in a lot of physical distress. But if you learn if you train yourself to enter deep samadhi, right, you know, you can find this imperturbable place. And when you find that imperturbable place and you create that distance between yourself and your thoughts, you're able to deal with the uncontrollability of your mental life. And actually, our mental lives are pretty much uncontrollable. You know, so as I say, you can't predict what the next thought will be in your head. It's just going to pop in there, you know. Your mind has its own causes and effects that are pushing thoughts along, but you can distance yourself from them, and you can find this place that's imperturbable. And this is, like, I think, incredibly valuable. You know, once you're able to do this, you know, the next step is if you stay in that state of imperturbability, immobility, you know, you begin to notice something very interesting, which is that your mind begins to go blank, you know. So you know, if you stay in that immobile state and you're observing, like, a thought go by, or you're listening to sound, you'll notice that there's a moment of consciousness. So you hear a sound, and the sound comes fully into your attention, and then it trails off. And as it trails off, you enter, like, there's an interval of blankness or emptiness. And we call this in Zen Mu Shin, empty mind, or Wu Shin, Wu Shin. And, you know, when you enter Wu Shin, this is a little deeper kind of imperturbability, right? It's absolutely like going back to zero. In fact, in Sanskrit, this was called shunyata, emptiness, zeroness. So, you know, when we get into shunyata, we're not just in a place that's imperturbable. We're reaching down into the deepest part of our mind, and we're sort of like undoing our mental knots. And when we untie our mental knots, our fears and our attachments, we can respond to change spontaneously and creatively. And normally, clinging to the past prevents us from doing that, right? So, you know, if you go into, let's say you went to a party, and you came into the room and you told a joke and everybody laughed. And then you told a story and everybody turned to you and all their eyes were on you and they laughed and they slapped you on the back. And when you left the party, you were the life of the party. People loved you. They thought you were funny. They thought you were witty. Okay, what a wonderful day. There's nothing wrong with that experience. Okay, so now you're going to another party. And you come in the room and you make a funny joke and nobody laughs. And in fact, you've offended somebody because you made a joke that had something to do with something that just happened to them, you know, and everybody knows it and they're all quiet. And then you try to break the ice with people, but every time everything you say seems to be treading on somebody's toes, you know. This has happened to all of us, I'm sure. You know, what we normally do is we're holding in our mind the image of that first party, and we're trying to make things the second time around be like the first time. But they're not going to be like the first time, and the more we hold on to that mental image, the worse it gets, right? What we should just say is, screw it, it's a different party, I'm just going to go with the flow. But it's so hard to let go, right? It's so hard to let go because we have deep emotional investments in certain kinds of outcomes, right? You know, so you know, when we go into the party, we're already bringing our insecurity. We're human beings. When we go to the party, we're bringing our insecurities, our loneliness, our unmet needs for love, you know, and when we went to the party that one time and everybody laughed, it's like all of this wonderful stuff was coming our way. You know, we felt, oh, I am a worthy person. I'm not stupid. I'm funny. I'm charming. I'm all the things I wanted to be, right? And then you go to the party the second time and it's confirming your worst fears about yourself. You're a bumpkin. You're socially incompetent. You're a dope, right? You know, and it's like, oh, so we have all of this baggage that prevents us from responding spontaneously to events as they change, and they never stop changing. So, you know, being able to find the imperturbable place, that samadhi, is really valuable. You distance yourself from what's happening around you, but that's not, you know, you could say that's not completely liberating because it's just distance. You want to be engaged with what's happening in a way that's creative and that's intelligent and compassionate. And that's so hard to do because we have all of this baggage that we carry with us, right? So when we are able to enter blank mind, empty mind, we're now in a place that's different from samadhi. You know, because samadhi is just imperturbable. But when we enter deep, empty mind, we begin to work with the obstacles. We can begin to undo our mental conditioning, our self-conditioning, or the conditioning that life has put us through. Begin to undo those lessons. And in our particular school of Zen, the way we do this is with koans. We have these little stories that people meditate on, and there's usually something called a turning phrase or a turning word. So, you know, when the teacher gives you a koan, you know, you go into that emptiness and then you internalize this phrase. And, you know, generally speaking, if the koan is successful, it brings up a lot of stuff that can be the source of great anxiety. You know, so it's definitely the case that, there's a koan that goes like this. Yakujo and Nansen and Yakujo, Nansen and Obaku were walking along, and I guess it was Yakujo, sorry. Nansen and Yakujo were walking along, and a duck flies by. And the teacher says to the student, "What was that?" And the student says, "A wild duck." And the teacher says to the student, "Where has it gone?" And the student says, "It's flown away." And the teacher grabs his nose and twists it until he screams, "Ouch!" And he says, "There, has it gone? You know, it hasn't gone away, has it?" Now, that's the koan. Right? So what you do is you sit down on the cushion, you enter deep wuxin, and then you say, "Flown away, flown away." The koan is flown away. So if you say "flown away," you know, you're sitting on the, you think, oh, this is a funny story about two Zen masters. A wild duck flies by. One Zen master says, "Where did it go?" The other student, the Zen student, said, "It flew away." The teacher squeezes his nose. Ha! Huh. You know, how funny. What a funny story. So you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep wuxin. You start saying, "Flown away, flown away." Pretty soon, all this stuff starts coming up. You start thinking about all the things in your life that have flown away. This could happen to you. It might not. I'm not giving you the answer to the koan, because everybody processes the koan a little differently. But you can begin to think about all the things in your life that have flown away. You know, lots of things in my life have flown away. My mother and father are long gone. My brother is long gone. You know, my father-in-law is long gone. My, you know, I can go on and on. I was young a long time ago, but that's flown away. You know, we've all had things taken from us in life, right? And so as you're working on this koan, you know, this funny story, you begin to feel like this sense of loss, maybe, right? It's loss. You know, this, I thought this was a funny story, but now I'm feeling really sad at all the things that I've lost in my life, or all the opportunities I've missed. You know, I could have done this and I didn't do it. Why didn't I do, you know? So this is precisely what holds us back, right? Prevents us from responding creatively to the moment. We have karma. You know, karma, you know, when I was growing up, there was a joke, my karma ran over your dogma. That was the joke, funny. But karma isn't the universe's revenge against you or something like that. Karma is the mental patterns or the energy habits, the mental patterns we create through repetition in our lives that become rigid and unyielding and that prevent us from responding creatively to the present moment. You know, so when we're sitting on the cushion and we're working with the koan, it can create an existential crisis, right? You know, you say, who am I? I thought I was the person who had it together, and now I see I've always been afraid of not having it together. And it can create an epistemic crisis because you say, what is real? What is real anyway? You know, Kurt isn't even real, which is true. And it can also create a lack of faith in institutions sometimes too. I mean, I can remember I was at one session where I couldn't get the answer to my koan. I was so mad at my teacher. I remember sitting on the cushion just thinking, this Zen is a bunch of crap. It's a lie, you know. Zen is a lie, you know. All of those crises happen to us in Zen, you could say, again and again. Again and again. You know, every time you work with a koan, you're in an existential, an epistemic, and an institutional crisis. And all of it gets flown, all of it gets flown away, you could say. So the thing is, this is the best training in the world, right? Because everything changes. And so, you know, what we're learning how to do is deal with change intelligently. And not hold on to the past, right? And not run away from change, not try to make things go in the direction we want, but, you know, being able to respond, you know, koan training is about responding creatively to change. And in order to do that, you have to work through your obstacles and let go of them. And, you know, when we, the most elementary koan is, besides the breath koan, is the mu koan. And we haven't, many of us have had the chance to do the mu koan in person, you know, at Murray Grove. And one of the things a teacher will do is say, okay, I want you to say mu on your out-breath. So you're saying mu, mu, mu on your out-breath. See? And you do that maybe for a couple of years. You immerse yourself in that emptiness, you see. But at some point, the teacher will say, okay, I want you to call mu. So people come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, you know, tell me about your practice. And I'll go, oh, everything is blank. It's like an ocean of emptiness. And I'll say, okay, now I want you to call mu out loud. It's like, what? And I'll say, I want you to call mu out loud. And they say, what do you mean? And I'll say, I want you to go, mu. You're kidding. No, no, please go moo. And they sort of say, moo, like that, right? It's like, you know, so many obstacles, so many obstacles. They think, God, if I really open my mouth and just say moo, I'll be such a horse's ass. You know, I'll be such a fool. I'll feel like a fool, right? You know, my mother always told me to keep my voice down. I can't, you know, she's long gone, but I can't raise my voice. She told me not to do it, right? So, So we have all of these conditioned responses that get in the way of just being spontaneous, right? Just being spontaneous. So I did the Mukhon for like 4 years, and I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and I couldn't even open my mouth. I would go into blankness, but I could not let myself free, right? I could not let myself respond openly and actively and freely. And, you know, I was like the last person in our community who hadn't answered the Mukhon. People, I would go to the Sesshin and I would hear people going into the Dokusan room and be like, moo, moo. I'd go in and I couldn't open my mouth. So finally, I kind of just gave up. And one day I went in and I just opened my mouth and it was just like this torrent, right, came out. And I didn't try. It was just getting out of my way. I just got out of my way. And, you know, and I, as a teacher, when students do that, you can kind of hear it. You can hear the release. You know, they're able to access this place that is deeper than their fears and their anxieties and their attachments. And you, it's like the sound of freedom, right? The first time sometimes people are able to just be truly spontaneous and creative from this deep place in themselves. But we don't necessarily trust that for a long time. We don't give ourselves permission to just let it out. So, you know, we're in a crisis. There's no question about it as a society. But you know, the truth is, it's always been a crisis and it will never not be a crisis. It's an illusion to think it wasn't a crisis yesterday, right? As I said, when I was a little boy, I used to lie in bed at night and hear jets going over our apartment complex in Baltimore and wonder if they were nuclear bombs, you know, about to attack Baltimore, you know? So you know, it's always been a crisis, right? It never is not going to be a crisis. You know, the world is constantly changing, and we can become, you know, truly alive if we are able to respond to these changes creatively, compassionately, and intelligently. And when we fail to do that, we become less alive and less intelligent and less compassionate and creative. So, you know, Buddhism is all about this. It's like living in crisis 101. And Zen brings it right to the center of practice. Every koan is a crisis, right? And after a while you think, you know, I actually like crisis, to tell you the truth, you know, because something really good can come out of every change. Something really good, really wonderful. You know, out of change can come the deepest human kindness, you know, much deep. You know, if you look at culture, if you look at our way of life, not that great, actually, even the best. You know, humans are better than any way of life they've ever developed. Inside of all of us is Buddha, Buddha nature. And there's no culture, not Tibet, not Japan, not ancient China, that fully expresses the Buddha nature in human beings. So a lot of work has to be done. And how are we going to let that Buddha nature out? We have to let everything go and reinvent ourselves and reinvent the world over and over again, coming from this place, this emptiness inside of us. And I think it would be a better group. Nansen came to see Hyakujo. Joe said, is there any Dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. In other words, let it all go. Let it all go. Joe said, you've just preached. Nansen said, I am like this. How about you? Joe said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there's preaching or no preaching? He's letting it all go. Okay, I'm going to reinvent everything right now. Nansen said, I don't follow you. Joe said, I've talked quite enough. In other words, Let's go back to zero and reinvent the world. Let's find compassion in ourselves and make this a better world. Setro's verse. Ancestors and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. They cling to the past. Clear mirror understand, sharply imaging. If your mind is like a clear image, everything just comes and goes without inhibition, without arresting your attention. Looking southward, see the Great Bear, the heavens above. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth. So, thank you so much for coming to practice today.